All right, we've got some software updates to discuss this week, some changes with Apple Music for good and bad, and some more funky stuff to get to. So let's knock it out. Mayo, tell me what's new in iOS this week.
Well, they had these incredible, revolutionary bug fix releases of iOS 12.1.2, which was rushed out because it was in the beta channel for a bit, but then it was rushed out over the weekend and came out on Monday because it included adjustments relating to the Qualcomm Apple patent battle in China, where Qualcomm's trying to enforce an iPhone ban, and obviously Apple doesn't want that to happen, and all of the Qualcomm's currently patents that they've got a temporary injunction on relate to software. So Apple's been radically saying that, oh, their software doesn't infringe, but just in case it does, we're rolling out fixes. This is what came through in the 12.1.2 release, and it was only released for the iPhone because obviously the ban only affects the iPhone, so Apple didn't have to rush anything else out. In terms of actual like customer features, it fixed some bugs with eSIM and cellular connectivity in Turkey. Apple keeps finding bugs with eSIM, apparently. It's just update after update of consistent eSIM fixes. Although finally now, all the major carriers do actually accept let you sign up with eSIM, like actually transfer over to eSIM in the US now, which is finally a progress. You haven't checked. Are you still on physical SIMs?
I don't really have a need for dual SIM, and I don't want to mess anything up, so I've not tried to switch to just eSIM or anything.
So, but if you are, have at it. The thing that interests me is, I think on the last episode, I said when they fix this stuff, it'll be like private implementation, boring the way the code does this stuff, because the core components are relating to how like apps are arranged using a touchscreen and photo editing. And it turns out that that was not the case. They actually have user-facing changes only activated in China as part of this 12.1.2 update. And the release notes included a new animation when force closing apps in the switcher, and then a changes to the share sheet when setting wallpaper and contact images. And as of recording, we still haven't quite worked out what changed with the share sheet,
I
but
think from what I think Michael Stieber gathered is that when you set your wallpaper in the settings app, you can position it, you can zoom in and out and
yeah,
move
like
left and
the
right.
move and scale thing.
Exactly. But if you use the share sheet to turn a photo into your wallpaper for the lock screen or home screen in China, now you can't reposition it. You still can from settings, but not from the Photos app share sheet. So they've had to remove that to avoid an iPhone ban and sales ban in China because of
So
Qualcomm.
you can't zoom in when you're in the Photos app to set a screenshot
Yeah, you've
anymore.
got to go to settings first and then pick your photo from that menu. That's
That's
crazy.
pretty funny. The bigger one is they've actually changed the animation when you're in the multitasking and you slide up to force quit an app, which actually fully kills it and removes it from memory. For a while now, when you slide up, it acts like a card that follows your finger and flies off the top of the screen as you flick it. In China now, there's no vertical movement. It just kind of like f scales down in place and then fades away. So that is apparently all they need to do to not be an infringement of the Qualcomm patent, which, funnily enough, is a patent that they bought from HP, who acquired Palm. So it's actually Palm rearing its head for finally getting recognition for kickstarting the whole card multitasking user interface paradigm that has proliferated across all smartphones since they did it in like 2010. But this is Qualcomm using a Palm patent against them. And if you actually look at the Palm patent, there's images of a hand making a card shaped app icon fly upwards with like vertically. And now in China, the iPhone does not do that. It just disappears in place. So if you don't have vertical movement, you're good, apparently,
Do you
which
think
is
that there's
hilarious.
any like software design that Apple would want to do but couldn't because they would need to pay some amount of money that they wouldn't like the way that iOS dismisses apps now when you're force quitting an app like they that's obviously what they want to do, but they had to apparently exchange money for that at some point. Do you think that there's something that they'd want to do but couldn't do because of patents?
I'm sure there has to be all over the place. Like, Apple did this to Android manufacturers with the slide to unlock pattern. With the this was like in the big like tirade of 2012, when essentially Apple had a pattern on moving an image from one location to another, and that obviously embodied itself in the old slide to unlock, where it was like a slider with the button on the screen and you had to move it from the left to the right. So it was like you're moving an object across the screen to unlock the phone. In response, Android manufacturers just changed to like, you just have to swipe anywhere on the screen and you're not necessarily moving an object under your finger.
Right.
And obviously later versions of iOS like 7, 8, 9 have kind of gone away from the old slide to unlock thing. So it doesn't really apply anymore in terms of how Apple's using it. But Android manufacturers definitely worked around Apple's patents at the time. And there must be stuff that Apple would like to do, but they can't. I mean, that's how the patent system works.
Like, yeah, it made me think, though, that like when you were going through the trail of like where the credit goes for that design, that just to like design iOS, you've got to figure out like, you know, A, what works on like a usability level, and then like B, what are we allowed to do, and like what's possible, and there's like so many layers of making sure everything works before you release it. Like there's probably so many good ideas that can't be released for different reasons like that.
Yeah, and this is like Apple does this. Apple holds patents to stop other companies from doing the same thing as well. Like, yeah. It's not like, oh, Apple's the innocent bystander. Like, no, in no way is that true. It's and this stuff works itself out, right? Like, I'm sure in a year's time they will have the actual animation they want back in China, right? It will be restored, and they'll either the Qualcomm case will have been rejected by the court eventually in the appeals, so the patent will be considered invalidated, or Apple will pay some amount of money that they've negotiated over a long period of time for that patent.
Right.
In fact, Pegatron already has coverage for that patent. It's based on the manufacturing, so like, but obviously most iPhones are made by Foxconn, and they do not have coverage on that patent at the moment. But in the 5 days that Apple's basically rushing around before the holidays to try and not get the iPhone banned, they're just doing the quick fixes, right? Let's just not allow any vertical movement whatsoever. Because if this patent was upheld in China and enforced, Qualcomm would then use that around the rest of the world as well. So in the US, they'd then do the same thing where this patent was shown to be right over here, so it must have precedence and it must be good over here. So then they'd try and get the same thing used in China as well. So at the very minimum, you'd get eventually the companies paying each other some amount of money once they, you know, do all the checks and balances. Or the patent gets overruled. But it's just this like interim time when Qualcomm has sort of managed to get a temporary injunction, that Apple's just trying to get that lifted as quickly as possible. And then they'll deal with all the rubbish down the road when they get there.
Yeah, yeah.
If that makes sense.
Yeah, yeah. And again, this is being enforced by the phone being sold from China, and Guy Rambeau found in code that the reference is green tea is the label for a device sold in China. So that's interesting. And that's what we saw with ECG, is that the ECG up on the watch is based on the watch being sold from the US. So if you in the UK bought a watch from the US, you could use the ECG app, I guess, as long as your region settings also match. So there's a lot of examples now, I guess, of the device like origin making a difference of features, and this is just the latest one.
And really quickly, I saw a few people like, I wish they put that animation elsewhere in the world, because they'd seen the screen capture of it, and it kind of looks cool. But if you actually think about how the gesture works, the way it's currently implemented in China, you lose the direct interaction of your finger. Like you swipe up, and you want the card to move with you, and it just doesn't anymore. So there is no way that I would want this animation to go worldwide.
Yeah.
Maybe by iOS 13, they change the whole multitasking system altogether, so there's a completely different animation. But if they carry on with this kind of card metaphor, the swiping up stuff is way better than the weird scaling down in place. Like, no restriction or qualification like whatsoever. I do not want this on my iPhone, full stop.
How does it vary from the reduced motion effect?
I haven't used reduced motion in a while, I can't remember, but reduced motion normally relies on like a crossfade.
Yeah,
so I believe it crossfades, and this does not crossfade. It kind of just, the single card moves away in the place, where normally reduced motion kind of changes the whole screen in one go.
Reduce motion, force quit my... Yeah, I'm in multi... Oh, that's so distressed, like so jarring, because this is different. Oh, reduce motion, the... when you're in reduced motion, the app flicks the same way as if you're not in reduced motion. The card just goes up in the air. So this is totally different than what reduced motion has. That's interesting. I would have thought that this was pretty similar to what reduced motion has, but reduced motion doesn't change from the normal.
They keep the direct interaction of the gesture.
Yeah, yeah. So it's still look at the card flinging up in the air and going away, but when, and then now in China, like it dissolves into itself, sort of. Yeah, goes away.
So there you go. Yep. Patterns, everybody.
Woo! Yeah, and then we did get iOS 12.1.3 developer beta as of today. Two. Yeah, and that's, so it's beta 2, even though it's the first version with this version number. And that's because, like, 12.1.2 that had the China fix is probably not the same code that was 12.1.2 developer beta 1. And, like, now we're back on this other track of, like, some, you know, unknown features in this version. But that were not the ones that were released last week. That was, like, a whole... You know, because of
the core and the way the software update like mechanism works is it sees the public version as being you can't have a clash of those three numbers because it confuses like the Apple software update system. So they have to advance the build number to the patch number to 0.3 for the everything to go back in order with how just iOS the operating system works.
Yeah, yeah. So these are not exciting betas, so but they are betas nonetheless. And so there we go. Also, this week like I said, we're gonna talk about Apple Music for a little bit. And there's like two big stories around Apple Music this week. The first one that we're gonna touch on is Apple Music Connect. I think we were probably first to this story this week, I didn't quite realize the scale of it until, you know, we had some time to let it settle. Jordan Kahn, who is a longtime 9to5 Mac editor, received an email that was from Apple, like to, you know, as an artist on Apple Music, he received an email from Apple Music that was about changes in Apple Music. And it said this. It said, "Today we're streamlining music discovery by removing Connect Post from artist pages and for you. This means you'll no longer be able to post to Connect as of December 13th, 2018, but all previously uploaded content will still be searchable until May 24th, 2019. You can still create artist playlists with the latest version of Apple Music." And there was also some other stuff that was in that email, but it was like, they didn't like say we're killing Connect, but that's what they were trying to say without saying it, like without admitting defeat on Apple Music Connect. And as we published this story, to say that artist content is being removed from Connect, from the For You page and artist pages, it was still like on my phone, so I wasn't quite confident enough to say like Connect is dead yet. But then, like within a matter of days, like that has all been removed from Apple Music, unless you just search for it. And
yeah, there was a support like KBase article they released, which had two big paragraphs talking about the new features of the artist pages and iOS 12, which had been out since 12.0, and we actually talked about it on the podcast before, how they like separate out now albums from compilations and EPs, and it's all separated, and you can do personalized artist radio stations now, and then in a very small fine print at the bottom, Connect posts from artists are no longer supported.
it's like, so on the For You page alone, like it's just so much cleaner now that there's not, you can scroll from top to bottom and it's all recommendations for you in different collections, and there's none of the Connect stuff. Like Connect started out as its own tab, and then it, like within iOS 10 or so, like after a couple of versions, it was quickly demoted into part of For You, you know, to like not have its own tab, and then also like you maybe you'll like stumble upon it there too. But it was obvious, like, Connect either needed to have a lot more invested in it or, you know, have this fate, which is to go away. And Apple wasn't going to put more into it, I guess. And so here we are.
And I wasn't surprised that Connect was a failure. I think the pro... Because Connect tried to be another social network. It tried to be another place where you write posts, you have your friends comment on those posts, they can upvote them with likes, and as well as your friends posting, they also started the thing with, oh, all these artists are going to do social media updates on inside this music app as well, and you'll see progress of song development and new tracks, and they'll communicate on there, and you can upvote and comment, and basically like Facebook, but inside of music, just for that purpose. And I think it's pretty obvious that that was never really going to get off the ground. And it was funny, like about a month ago, I was just looking around Apple Music and you just see the Kinect rubbish. Just, it wasn't in your face because it was always below, but like it was always there and got in the way. And it just dirtied up the experience. You'd, because it was so abandoned, you'd go onto like an artist page and they'd have a Kinect post from 2.5 years ago at the bottom. And it's like, this just looks immature. It looks childish. It looks rubbish.
Yeah, several episodes ago, we talked about how, with Kinect, that like Apple Music has some really good new social features that they keep like building on top of. But Kinect, like the worst thing about it was you could easily tell when Kinect launched because there were probably like artist obligations to participate in it, or at least like excitement about it, and you could see like, oh, that's when Kinect launches, because it's like there's a lot of content and then there's like nothing after that. And I followed a lot of artists and it's like there just wasn't much there that you couldn't also find like elsewhere. No one was using it exclusively, and like, you know, there wasn't a big...
it was all reposts.
Yeah.
Even when it was used,
yeah, it was all cross-posted content. And even with following a lot of artists in Kinect, the most of the content that I'd find would be like from Apple genre collections, where like Apple was actively using Kinect to post things. And so when I was writing my story, I thought maybe because of how, you know, indirect they were being about saying Kinect is going away, that maybe they would just like repurpose Kinect as like an Apple, you know, like they promote like Beats One shows through Kinect, and they promote like kind of they use the browse tab and like all their curated sections, but nope, it's totally gone. Like, it's not in the For You section anymore. It's not a part of the artist pages anymore. It's still in search results, which is kind of spammy. Like, on one hand, like removing content that was posted is too bad. Like, you know, you wasted time on it, but there just wasn't that much stuff, so it's not that big of a deal, I don't think.
Nobody cares if you delete the Apple Music. People won't even remember that they posted them.
Yeah.
It's just, no, just, it'll go away. Give it a few.
Because
the thing that I, after it got axed, I then, like, it was bad enough trying to recreate being another social network, but if you actually look at most artists' social media on Twitter and Facebook, they're like primary outlooks, you don't see any of them posting that much of actually good content. Like, it was so idealistic that artists were going to be posting lyrics and they were going to be showing how they made a song and their progress on the album and all of this. And it's like, well, no, if you actually look at a lot of artists' Twitter, they just post when they have a new song out and that's about it. And then if there's an upcoming concert, there's a concert announcement, and then nothing. It's just like promotion. There's no like personality there. It's no like personal social content really on most artists.
Yeah, a lot of the artists that I follow that are active on social media, it's mostly, you know, like social media managers promoting merchandise. Like, here's a t-shirt promotion. You know, that was like part of the business. And, you know, because an album comes out like every few years and a tour happens, you know, around that. And then there's gaps in between. And, you know, what I was thinking with Kinect is like, if they tried to invest in it, what it would have is a way for artists to sell merchandise through Apple Music, like, you know, with Apple Pay or however, concert tickets, announce concerts through Apple Music.
Concert dates.
Yeah, exactly.
Upcoming album releases. That'd be what would keep the service alive and like vibrant.
Yeah, and instead of
can do that.
They still could do that. It wouldn't need to be called Kinect. You know.
Yeah, like you don't need the feed of posts. You can just in the artist page. You could have like they have now a section for latest releases. They could have a section for upcoming concerts. And you know what? You could buy the concert from within the music app. Apple gets a little cut of the money. The artist gets most of the money, and that could be a quote unquote service. Like the things that are actually like compelling. You don't need, it has to be in a square box that has light buttons on it. Like, that timeline thing is just completely unnecessary. Like, and if artists aren't doing it on Twitter and Facebook, they weren't going to do it somewhere else as well. That's even smaller, an even smaller subset.
Yeah. Now, you know, it's easy to compare Kinect to Ping, which was like the social network part of iTunes that also had the same fate. But I think iTunes, I think Apple Music does a better job of social than iTunes Ping ever kind of tried to do. Like, my recollection of Ping is that Connect was primarily for artists to share to fans, and Ping was like artist and fans, and it was a lot of you share what you're listening to, like actively. Like, if you're listening to a new album, you manually post it to Ping.
Yeah.
And then you can also like share that, you know, to Facebook or Twitter with like a Ping hashtag. And at the early days, like, they launched with Facebook, from what I recall, but then like they didn't really have permission to do that, and then it went away. And then like,
yeah, they announced it with Facebook integration,
and the integration was that you could find your Facebook friends on Ping. Like, if you have Facebook and your friend has Facebook, and this is like, well, like, what was it, like 2010 or so? I don't know.
Yeah, September 2010 it would have been. Oh, cool. iTunes 10 as well. Yeah, with the new icon.
Nice. And that if you sign up for Ping and you connect your Facebook account, then and your friends on Facebook have too, then you could friend your Facebook friends on Ping. It's like another bucket. And then you've got to actively, like, you know, I remember like liking albums on iTunes that came out, just like, but it was all proactive. Like, you had to manually do these things.
Yep.
And it just, like, it was, at best, it was like a way to broadcast on another platform that I like this music that you might not know about, but it was all like manual. You had to think about it and do it.
Yeah. And it was, again, post-based, right? It wasn't like just a transient, like, scrobbling or just waiting around. It was, you had to make a post, other people would comment on the post, and Apple kind of buoyed it up, like, oh, everyone's going to use it because it's going to be permanently visible in this sidebar of iTunes, the app everybody uses. So it's going to become popular just like by osmosis.
Yeah.
And then it obviously never panned out. And yeah, the Facebook integration never launched because Facebook cut API access before it actually shipped. And then about a month later, Apple announced Twitter integration as a kind of make-do. Like, we don't have Facebook anymore, we can have Twitter. And the Twitter integration by default would tweet out every single post that you made.
Right.
So everyone turned that off as well, because it was obviously, like, on Twitter, you don't want to spam people with just endless music. It was just, it'd just be like a link to the song in iTunes. And back then, because there was no streaming, the social was even more limited, because if you had a new song that you really liked and you shared it, like, all they could get was like a 30-second preview. You couldn't actually listen to the music and enjoy it.
To buy, like, it, exactly.
Yeah. Like, the streaming element of, oh, you can just access all this music is a huge part of, like, modern-day discovery. Back then, it was like, oh, you get to know the name of the song, and now you can buy it if you want. It's like, no, nobody's going to do that.
So, like, ha-ha, you know, iTunes Ping was bad, went away. Ha-ha, Apple Music Connect was bad, went away. We all saw it coming. But, like, Apple Music does not get enough credit for what is, like, an unbranded feature within Apple Music, which is like all the social features where you can connect with friends, you can follow, it's called friends, but like it doesn't connect you both ways automatically. So it's like on Twitter versus on Facebook. Like, we're on Facebook, you can also follow, but like, by default, if you're a friend, then you follow each other. And on Twitter, like, it's a one-way connection unless you like mutually follow each other. On Apple Music, if you're a friend of somebody, like, then you follow them and they can choose to follow you or not. And you can opt to share, like, just passively share what you listen to from all your devices. And all you do is just listen to music that you enjoy, and then your friends see it and creates recommendations. There's even a playlist, the Friends Mix, that's literally based on, like, what you listen to for your friends of, like, 20, 25 songs.
Yeah, and at the top, like, the top of the For You feed, there's a Friends I Listen To You row, and it just shows recent songs and albums with the little avatars.
Yeah.
And if three people listen to the same thing, it doesn't put three copies of the album in the list. It just stacks the icons up on the same album.
Yep.
So you kind of get it. Like, I know you've been listening to Apple Music Christmas Classics recently.
Christmas Classics and Classic Christmas. They're different.
They're different.
They really are. But yeah, I love the Friends features. Like, the Friends you're listening to, it's prominent. It's right below the For You mixes. And it's like, if I see, you know, I try and, like, just populate who I follow, have a big variety. I have no idea what they like, what their taste is. I just want to just see. I like them for a different reason. What music do they like? And people follow me as well. And I love seeing, like, oh, I didn't know they liked this kind of music. That's really cool. Or I kind of like that artist. There's new stuff from them. Like, I find it that way. I find that I use the friends features. Like, the For You mixes are great. I rarely go to the browse tab and, like, just, like, look for stuff. But the friends stuff, like, I think I use the friends stuff as much in Apple Music as I use curated playlists on Beats Music. And even though those still exist on Apple Music, like, I don't tend to look for, like, artist playlists or, like, the ones that Apple makes anymore. It's a lot of just, like, what are friends listening to and, like, recommendations by that method. And I really enjoy it. And there's a whole aspect where you can subscribe to playlists that friends make on their own and share. And I've done a few things where, like, if I have a good new music mix or favorites mix that I like, I'll save it and label it for the week it came out. And then I'll share it on my profile and, like, people can go and find that. Or if I do, like each time I do a half marathon run, I'll make a playlist for the run ahead of time. And then I'll label it, give it some artwork, you know, something connected to the race or something. And people can go to my profile and they can, like, subscribe to that playlist or save it to the library. And I love to get those alerts because it's like someone added your playlist to their library. You get an alert for it. It's like, that's kind of neat, you know? And I'm not an artist. I'm just like, music I like, a playlist that I made for myself. It's shareable. Someone can add to their library. And I love the social features. And there's no, like, ping, connect, like, label for all of that. It's just
part there's no like umbrella product. Term for it, right?
It's just yeah.
part of Apple Music.
Yeah, it's really good.
Like the shared playlists, I think some people don't know they exist because they don't show up as prominently. Like, on the For You feed, it doesn't show you, like, playlists from your friends. You kind of have to dig in more to see them.
Yeah.
So that's but even when you're making a shared playlist, which is, like, the most amount of work that you can do on Apple Music socially, it's still barely anything. Like, would you give it a name and that's about it, and then you press share and you're done. Like,
yep.
Or the passive music, it just, you don't have to do anything. You don't have to, like, and you don't have to get any notifications back either. Like, you don't have to worry that someone's commented on it or someone's done this or someone's done that or someone else is listening to it. Like, if you go onto the For You feed, you'll see, oh, they listen to it. Like, you can just look and see, oh, I was listening to this last week. Now they're listening to it. Mm-hmm. Maybe I'll message them. And you don't have to message them inside the Apple Music silo because it doesn't exist. Like, there's no chat or anything. So what do? You go onto iMessage, you go onto Facebook, you go on Twitter, you talk to them somewhere else, and you just start a conversation based on just an endless stream of music. And this is a concept that I think kind of, I don't know if this was big in America, but Last.fm, have you heard of that website?
Yep, Last.fm.
Yeah. Yeah, so that was huge at my, like, secondary school and stuff, like, 10 years ago now, 5 years ago, in the UK. Like, it was a huge thing. It was called, like, scrobbling, and it would automatically upload the music you played in a big list, and you could see what your other friends would listen to. And that was, like, massive. And again, it's because it's automatic. You're already tweeting. You're already Facebook posting. And you just have a stream of music, and you just look at it, and it's that simple. Like, it doesn't get credit because there's nothing to it, but that's what makes it good.
Yeah. Like,
I wish there was an App Store thing. I wish I could see the equivalent of friends I listen to is, like, apps my friends are using. Like, I don't want to do, like, a social network. I just want a stream of, like, here's the apps my friends use. Here's the ones they've downloaded recently. Done. Finish. It helps with discovery. It's nice. And if you really, really don't like it, you just scroll past it. You don't have to worry about it. Like, it's just it just turns into another recommendation at the end of the day. And you, if there's something that, like, a music taste that you really don't agree with, you can unfollow them. No one's going to care. It's not like Facebook where it's like, ooh, there's a big timeline and newsfeed of stuff going on. And
yeah,
it's just so freeing, really. Like, there's no obligation to it, which is why it succeeds.
You know who's pretty good at making and sharing playlists on Apple Music? Phil Schiller.
Really?
Yeah, and like, there are verified accounts for friends on Apple Music, for, I guess, your profile on Apple Music, and, like, only Apple executives have them. So, like, Schiller, Q, I think that's it that I know of. But he's pretty active, and he'll make, like, I guess it's him. I emailed once to ask, like, is this actually you, and didn't get a response. But, like, it's a pretty diverse mix of music. But like they're clearly like thought out playlists that are put together. And maybe it's just that he's the marketing guy, so like someone did it for him. But I kinda think that like it's probably him doing it. Like, I think he's better than Eddie Q is at Apple Music playlist.
And I think it'd be kinda cool if you could like follow more celebrities on there. And again, it wouldn't be posts. It would just
like
be
only if it's
streams of music.
Only if it's like actually the celebrities and like what they're using. Like if they happen to use Apple Music and they actively.
And we know almost all celebrities use iPhones. Let's be realistic. Like, yeah. you get a big thing, and it could be like if you share your recent music, we will feature your new album. Like that could be the marketing arrangement on the back end.
Yeah.
Like you see the stream of Taylor Swift music, and you also get a nice prominent badge for a new album. That's how they play it, right? Like, and I'm sure people would love that. Like, oh, Taylor Swift listened to this. I can listen to this too. It's great. Like, oh, Taylor Swift and Ed Sheeran listen to this music at the same time. Like, it would just be. And again, it doesn't require them to do work. Like, they'd just be walking around their day, listen to music on their phone, and that would be it. And it doesn't have to be. It doesn't even have to be music celebrities. Like, just think of anyone in the world. Like, big names, TV stars. That's like people would love that. Just, oh, I'm following these people. And there's just music coming in, and Apple wouldn't have to worry about, oh, what happens in 3 months? They stop posting because there's nothing to do. Like everyone listens to music.
Like the worst thing to worry about with sharing music that you listen to is if you listen to something embarrassing, like, and you want to go and remove it. Like then, I guess there's a method that you can do that, but you've got to do it manually. But like that's still.
Here's actually a funny aside, right?
Yeah.
I was walking home at the weekend. With my AirPods in my ears, it was raining, so there was like a lot of background noise. And I asked my AirPods, activated Siri, and I asked it to play some new music while I was walking home. That's what I asked. I don't know how it heard it as what it did, but it started playing an album that purely consisted of fart noises. Like, it was funny fart noises at compilation, and it was like 30 tracks of just
was,
those.
Was that new music for you though?
Well, I've never listened to it before, but I am pretty sure it heard my request as asking for the album. It wasn't suggesting it as something I'd like. I'm pretty sure it just for some reason heard play the album that has fart noises in the name, and that's what happened. And that turned up on my feed.
Yeah, yeah.
I was like, well, this is a bit weird. So I kind of like guessed at trying to remove it from my page and I couldn't work it out. So then I Googled it. And of course, obviously the most discoverable method, you have to 3D touch on the album when it's in your recently played stream. And when you 3D touch on it, in addition to all the normal controls that normally appear when you 3D touch on an album, at the very top it says hide from profile so you can remove it. But that is like one embarrassing instance since the features come out, right?
Yeah.
And at the end of the day, it was like if someone had noticed and they'd have messaged me about it, you just tell them, you know, it was just a mistake. Like, it's not like it's not political, really. Do you know what I mean? Like,
yeah, yeah.
There's very little stuff that, and even if you were like even if they really wanted to get serious about this, they could make it so that you have to like for instance, if you're a big star, you could like have an option in your profile which says only share chart music, right? So you could never be too out there, for instance, and you still get the feeling of like when people listen to popular music, oh, I like it. But if they went and listened to something really weird, it just would never populate onto the profile. Like there are little like safeguards they could put in to eliminate pretty much all of the weirdness around it. It's so much easier than imagine if you had a stream of like what news articles people are reading. Like that's a completely different bucket and embroiled with problems. Music's like casual.
Yep. And I've had people like direct message me and say, hey, I saw you on Apple Music and I can't believe you like the same artist as me and here are some more recommendations that you should check out. And like that isn't neat because like music can feel very personal and like what you're exposed to and like what you connect with, it can vary from person to person so much that whenever you find crossover, then it kind of feels neat, like you've got something in common that you otherwise might not discover. So I'm a humongous fan of the social features in Apple Music. Ping, I tried it, you know, it didn't stick. Connect wasn't really for fans. It was more for artists to share with to fans. I think Connect, like as intended, could could be something if it was invested in more from Apple, but like it was launched and that was and it was left to die. So it's too bad that went away. But like the unbranded social features of Apple Music are really good, and I don't know where they can like take it next, but like it's as is, like it's already a good recommendation engine for me, and I'm happy with that.
Yeah, I've got one suggestion just to kind of close it out. In the same vein as passively friends are listening to, what if you had friends have loved recently? So you know when you're listening to music and then you have to press the heart to say you like it?
Yep, which I
do. What if that was just a friend stream?
Mm-hmm.
Like, obviously it's not as passive as listening, but it's, you know, slightly more restrained. And it doesn't require you to do anything different than if you were just organizing your own music and saying what you like. Yep. But that just gets proliferated out to friends as well. And it could be an option, because I can see why some people might not want that, but you can turn it on and off, and that would just kind of, even if it didn't even need to be like a separate category, it would just like friends are listening to, it would also have a little icon that showed they really hearted it, so they really liked it. Like, you don't even necessarily need a whole separate row for it. It could just be an extension of the thing, like a better signal for, oh, this person really liked this song, maybe I should listen to it now.
Hi, Mayo. Something that happened on Friday, which was a few days earlier than kind of expected, was Apple Music went live on Amazon Echo. And I was very excited for this. I was kind of on my calendar for Monday. I think it was December 17th. They said the week.
Yeah, they said week of December 17th. Yeah, so it could have been any day that week.
Obviously. Exactly. And instead, it was on Friday, December 14th. And the way that I found out about it, this was another story that 95 Mac was first to run, which is always fun, is that a reader or listener on Twitter had tweeted with me that he was disappointed that Apple Music didn't work with Amazon with Alexa on Sonos, and my immediate reply was, "I think we've got to wait until it comes out on Monday, and then we'll see. It might not work, but we've got to wait until it comes out at first." And he was like, "Oh," and then the guy said, "Oh, I thought it was out." And then I had to go and just double check, and I'm like, "Oh, look at that! You can actually add Apple Music now." And so we got to test it out, write about it, and everything. And it's kind of just as we suspected, which you know.
And it doesn't work on Sonos. Let's get out of the way.
and he was correct. Yeah, but it's kind of as you mentioned last week, which was Amazon has a music API that was announced in September, released at the end of October, and Apple used that to write Apple Music for Alexa. And because of that, Apple Music gets to benefit from being like a first-class service option where you can set it as your default library, so that when you ask for music with Alexa, it plays from Apple Music without you having to specify that you want Spotify or Apple Music or Amazon or Pandora. And the same thing for stations. So you can say, play Christmas music, and it will play a station on Apple Music, you know, a playlist on Apple Music. And it seems to work quite well. Like, the only thing that I missed from the initial launch day was I tried to request music that I knew that I uploaded to Apple Music myself with iCloud Music Library. So live versions of albums or instrumental versions of albums. And I just couldn't make it work. And so the weekend went by. I thought that was it. On Tuesday, I think it was, Apple, the App Store had a big feature about Alexa, the Alexa app with Apple Music integration now. And they had a tidbit there that I didn't know about, which is you can play music that you add yourself, but it has to be on a playlist, which is kind of a wonky workaround that I'm not going to bother with. Because you just want the music to be in your library and you call it up, not to have to do an extra step like that. Like, HomePod can play anything from iCloud Music Library, regardless of playlist.
Do you have to say play the playlist, or can you add it to the playlist and then play the songs in the playlist just by saying their names?
I think you've got to say the playlist name.
Right. So that's a non-feature as far as I'm concerned. Yeah, if it was like you have to add it to the playlist and then it picks it up, then you'd be okay, because I can just add my
one playlist of all the songs that you add yourself. Yeah,
yeah, or I can just add my like 50 favorite albums that I've uploaded myself to the thing, and I'll just call it the Alexa playlist and be done.
Right, but
if it's just, oh, now you can play the Alexa playlist and go back and forward, then yeah, that's just silly. And it's like. It's hard because I don't think it's like Apple trying to hold back on the feature set. There must be like a technical reason why can't do it.
It's surely something to do with the API that Amazon's presented.
Or where Apple stores the music on either side. Like, yeah. Maybe the uploaded music is stored in a different place to where the other stuff is, so it can't stream straight on Amazon servers or have you know how the API works differently.
It's on the it's on the iTunes Match Warehouse. Yeah, and we found out, I mean, we kind of suspected this too, but because they're using the music API, like, you can do things on Amazon Echo speakers with Apple Music that you cannot do in HomePod. Like, basic things like set an alarm with Apple Music as the tone. And this can be, and I think it can be a song, an artist, an album, a playlist, a station. Like, it's really flexible. And you just say, you know, Alexa, set an alarm for 5 a.m., to Christmas music, and then that speaker will start playing Christmas music at 5 a.m. as your alarm. And I've used this, and it works, and it's really like surely HomePod has to get that in 2019, but now it won't just be like catching up with what should have been there already. It'll be like, now it can do what Apple Music can do on Echo speakers. So it's kind of crazy.
It's absolutely ridiculous. Like, yeah, imagine you're a company that releases a smart speaker that's connected to the internet, and the same company releases a 24/7 internet radio station. And the smart speaker can act as an alarm clock, but you can't be a radio clock like has existed for 50 years in analog form.
Can't wake
and
up
you cannot
to
play on the HomePod. You cannot wake up to Beats One. Whether you want to or whether you don't want to is completely different matter. But you just can't do it. Like, the HomePod can't even have a different alarm tone. You get one tone choice and that's it.
Yeah, and it's crazy because, like, on iOS, on the iPhone, iPad, and iPod Touch, you can set an alarm, if you do this manually in the clock app, and pick at least a song. I think that's as far as you can go as a song. Like, I don't think you can do station, artist, album, any of that. I think it's got to be just one song. And in my experience, that is a great way to learn to hate your favorite song, because all of a sudden, like, the first few seconds of that song becomes like your wake up mood, and it's not good. It's not good. But like the idea of, like, you know, an alarm that's more general than just like one song is useful. And it's crazy that, like, on iOS, you've got one step closer to that than you've got on HomePod. And surely, like, it's got to be in the cards for 2019. It would be crazy if not.
And you've just seen Alexa now leapfrog you fully.
Yeah, and I think Sonos could also do this thing with music alarms for, like since forever. And it works with Apple Music. So, you know, it's just another example of...
Well, it's nothing, like, innovative. It's the same feature that's been on analog clocks for 30 years with FM radio. It's like, it's not like some magic invention. It's like, just do it. Like, there's no it's just an example of, like, the HomePod not being primary concern at the
moment. There's like loads of those weird examples of, like, why can't you crossfade music on Apple Music or in the music app on iOS? You can on iTunes, but you cannot on the music app, but you can on Spotify on iOS. Like, it's just so, like, such low-hanging fruit. That's, like, obvious stuff that maybe they just don't care about and they will never get to, but they should have, like, one intern just do it.
And we have seen HomePod updates this year, but they're coming from behind, and clearly they don't have that many people working on it, because they've actually had, what, three major updates this year with AirPlay 2 support, but that also was coming to iOS as well. Then they added calendars in, like, June, and then they had the September update where they did, like, multiple timers and phone calls and stuff. Mm. And they were great improvements, but if you look at what the what Amazon does with Echo and Alexa, they roll out new features every 2 weeks.
Like, it's a really
you get, like,
platform,
a weekly newsletter of what's new in Echo world. Like, the HomePod doesn't need to be on that kind of cadence, but it needs, you know, regular updates. And so I would hope to see in 12.2, right, which will be, like, early next year, a major improvement for the HomePod. And then 12.3, you have a major improvement for the HomePod. And then 13, you have a major improvement. Mm-hmm. And they've done okay with that, like, so far this year, but there's only been, like, two major flagpoles. And they need to do a lot more.
Yeah.
And they haven't, like, committed to it either. So that's why, at the moment, it's like a big question mark. They haven't said they're going to keep... They have an active roadmap on this. Yeah, we hope they do, but we don't know yet.
It isn't like with iOS where they have WWDC and they say these are things that are coming with... Like, we don't even see that for HomePod. It's just, like, when it's out, it's out. And surprise. Something else that you can do with Alexa that I think will work with Apple Music, I've not tried it yet, but they've got an automation feature called Routines, where you can do things like, I think at a set time, you could do something like set the volume to 3, which is like 30% on Echo speakers, and play something. You can involve music, and so I think you could probably do Apple Music this way as well, and see why you couldn't. So that's something I want to play with, is like see if I can do an automation with Apple Music that you would want to do with HomePod but can't yet. Because I think you could do stuff like location, like when I arrive, play this kind of music if it's a certain time. So I want to play around with that and see what you can do with it. But so far I've been really impressed with like what we thought we could do is what you can do. The worst thing about it is that it's only in the United States, which is a big bummer for a lot of people. That seems to be a limit of Amazon's music API, because obviously Apple Music is in over 100 countries, yet Amazon likes to focus on the US first and for a long time before they expand. I saw one reader say that they had a US Amazon account, and their Apple Music account was, I think, from Israel, and they weren't able to make that connection work, and that Apple took the blame for that, but I'm not sure. So at any rate, like the Amazon Music API being limited to the US like has to be the bottleneck there, and like once that expands, then Apple Music will be on Echo in more places. But as it is, and they've also said kind of like quietly that they'll be on other speakers too that have Alexa built in, like Sonos. Because the situation with Sonos is so funny. Like, you can control Apple Music on Sonos through the app, and you can use Alexa on new Sonos speakers, but you can't connect those two things together yet. And it's like, it's just that's, you know, a result of like there being three or four companies involved in all of this and having to connect, you know, to talk to each other the right way. But I think it's getting there. And the thing is, like, with HomePod, I really like Echo speakers because of Alexa and like what they're able to do. Like you can do things like you've always, like, for the longest time since before HomePod was available, you could connect your iCloud calendar to Echo because it's just a calendar, and you can't like really do reminders well, but you can use If This Then That to kind of be the middleman there, and then like add reminders to If This Then That using your Alexa shopping list or reminders list, and then they go to reminders, but it doesn't go back and forth very well, so I'm not bothered with that. And like I said last week, you can't do like Apple Podcasts and have it sync with the Apple Podcast app with Alexa. So for HomePod, like, I'm still enjoying it for the things that Siri can do, like talk to Apple reminders that I use heavily, you know, Siri Kit stuff like talk to things, which I use heavily, you know, play podcast. But for music, like, it's a funny thing. It's like I'm now deciding, do I want this to be on the HomePod, which is like, you know, AirPlay 2 land, which is really nice, or do I want it to be on Echo, where I can say play everywhere, and it's like I've just got more Echoes in more places, and it's, you know, it's a decision. Like, I think the best case scenario is that Echo picks up AirPlay 2, and then you could, like, everyone would talk the AirPlay 2 language, and you could say like tell Siri to play this music everywhere, and like the Echoes will be picked up from that method too. But in general, like, it's really, I was excited for this to come, for Apple Music to come to Echo, and what they delivered, I'm really happy with them. And I'm using Apple Music more on Echo speakers than I am on HomePod right now, which is kind of weird given like the cost differences and everything. But it's just like, sometimes I don't need like the best speaker to play the music, you know. If it's like just for like quiet home music, it's not bad.
Yeah, and the Echo ecosystem offers form factor flexibility.
Yes, that, yes,
Apple does not, right? Like,
it's a huge factor.
I wouldn't have bought Echo equipment, because I at the moment don't have any Echo devices.
Right.
I now would actually consider getting like a Dot or something, and all it did was play Apple Music, and I just connected it up to other speakers, or just had it as a little satellite somewhere in a different room, like somewhere that it doesn't really make sense to have a HomePod just sitting there. Like, but now I can just get a little Dot and jerry-rig it up and just ask it to play some music and get on with my day. Like, it's... Apple's not stupid. They know this, right? If they don't offer a HomePod type product that's cheaper and smaller, then people are going to obviously use Apple Music on a different platform that supports Apple Music and lets you buy a smart speaker device that is smaller and cheaper. Like, they obviously killed off the AirPort Express, which could have been a kind of future. If it had been updated, it could have been like a new Apple Music satellite thing, but they don't offer it. Maybe they will next year, maybe they won't, who knows. But for now, like, of course you would. The Echo's ecosystem is great here, and it doesn't disadvantage Apple's like sales, because for instance, say if where I'm thinking of putting them, I wasn't going to buy a HomePod, but now buy an Echo and reinforce the Apple Music connection. It's not like they're not, Apple's not, there's going to be very few people who, oh, I was going to buy a HomePod for here, but now I'm going to buy this thing instead. Like, if you weren't going to buy a HomePod, then you weren't going to buy a HomePod for that place. Like, it's right. Just, it's not how that equation works in your head. And it makes, Apple's a services company. That's what they're transforming into. And if they're going to have Apple Music on Android, if they're going to have Apple Music on Sonos, putting Apple Music on an Echo is fine. Like, you're just expanding the base. It's like how you put iTunes on Windows to make the iPod more successful. You put Apple Music in more places so that people can subscribe to Apple Music. And of course, you would say that, you know, Apple Music is best on these devices. And I'm sure Apple would never tell you to go and buy the Echo base or whatever that, you know, the one that's the closest to the HomePod competitor.
Yeah.
They're never going to go and tell you to buy that. They're going to tell you to buy a HomePod. But in the areas where Siri is underserved in the hardware level, I'm sure it's a great option. I wouldn't even be surprised if they sold Dots at Apple retail eventually. Like, if they're not going to offer something themselves, I don't see what the problem with it is. Like,
yeah, it's a good point. The thing is, like, there are things that I don't know that you can do, like if adding a song to your library from an Echo speaker. I'm not sure that you can do that. That you can say, I like, if you listen to a station, I'm not sure that you can say, I like the song, add it to my library. I don't think that'll work. But with HomePod, it would work because it's made to do that. And then, you know, with HomePod, it's got all the things that Siri has. So, and I hadn't mentioned that this week yet, but like with Alexa, you've got their smart home stuff. And their app has gotten way better than last year when I felt terrible about how their app was and how the smart home stuff was. It's gotten much better since then, but it's still heavily based on these skills that developers need to maintain and that often get abandoned. And with HomeKit, it's like once it's built, it doesn't break in my experience. But with Alexa smart home skills, often what I'll see is that it worked at one point and then something broke about it and then no one cared to fix it. And so like all of a sudden, even though it's advertised as works with Alexa, it might not actually work with Alexa anymore. So I super prefer Siri and HomePods with HomeKit for smart home control, like totally. Not to mention the Home app being, you know, just a better controller than digging into the Alexa app for that kind of stuff. But that's what's frustrating is like there's not really one best solution here yet because HomePod has things that it's better at, even at its premium price that don't relate to sound. It's just, you know, mm-hmm. access to services. And
plenty of areas where it's worse.
and then stuff that Echo can do, like, you know, wake you up to, you know, music is like, that's wild. Like, I really hope Apple catches up with like what they're offering because I love that they're sharing Apple Music with Amazon speakers now. I just also hope that they don't let that, you know, say be an excuse not to improve HomePod. Like, I hope the HomePod business continues to be in, you know, they invest in it and they update the software and they make different versions and different price points. Like, they need to go extremely down market, I think. They're clearly interested in this like, you know, $50 speaker zone. They could sell one for $60, $70, you know. There's
yeah, like
350 gives them a big range just to go from, you know, with.
Yeah, like the HomePod Mini, which you kind of imagine is just like take the HomePod and make it a bit smaller and it'd be in like the $150 to $200 range. That was kind of where I was thinking they'd be going next with the HomePod line, but I've kind of reconsidered, and if you put like a Dot equivalent, which maybe has AirPlay 2 and has Siri on it, like the HomePod Dot, whatever you want to call it, and that's in the $50-$60 price range. You have that, and then you have the $300 HomePod at the other end of the spectrum. Like, that gives you a nice differentiated product lineup, where if you have like a HomePod bigger than a HomePod mini, which is like, the HomePod mini would probably cannibalize the big HomePod by a lot, whereas if you have the dot kind of form factor, is very clear that this is for different places. This is for the bathroom, or this is for, you know, the tiny kids' room, or a proper like living room lounge HomePod speakers clearly aren't appropriate. Like,
yeah, like you wouldn't buy...
and that would be the future of the Airport Express. I'm still sorry about that, but yeah, there you go.
Like you wouldn't buy a $350 stereo system for every room. And you definitely wouldn't buy a $700 stereo system for every room. But it is reasonable to put a $20 speaker in every room. Like, that's not insane. And that's what you can get an Echo Dot 2 for right now. And the Echo Dot 3 is like $25. That's holiday pricing. I think the regular pricing is like $40 and $50. And that's still like reasonable. And Apple could have their tax and like make it like $60 or $70. Like, you know, those are compelling. And they're different enough from HomePod as it is today, but like, it totally needs to exist. And like, the first and second Echo Dots weren't great. Like, they didn't look great, they didn't sound great, they were just nice input sources for Alexa. The Echo Dot 3, like, it looks fine, and it sounds, for what it is, fine. Like, it's kind of impressive for its size. It's like no HomePod at all. It's like, you got to go to the $100 price point to get good sound, really. But there's something to it, and I think Apple could probably do some impressive stuff with sound, even at like the $80-$200 price range, if that's what they're going to go.
Yeah, and smaller sizes.
Yeah, but they're good at that kind of stuff.
Because even if they didn't put Siri on it, which is insane, because they're going to, because it needs voice control.
They're going to need Siri, yeah.
But the primary reason that this $60-$70 thing should exist is to support the Apple Music ecosystem. Yeah. Like,
and HomeKit, and like iCloud services. I mean,
yeah, like, lots of things involved there. Don't worry about that. Oh, you're not really making any money on this. Like, you're getting people on your service subscriptions, whether that's iCloud, whether that's Apple Music. Maybe there'll even be other stuff down the road. Like, Apple's going all in services in 10 different ways. And you know what you generally need for that? Speakers. Like, it's just, they need to expand the install base of their devices, so the total number of Apple stuff in the world. And to do that, you're going to need cheaper stuff. And starting with a cheap speaker, you know, mini dot spaceship UFO thing is a great entrance there.
Like one thing that's not really rumored, but Apple rebranded iBooks to Apple Books, and there is an audiobook section. Like, they could have a subscription service that is like what Amazon Audible is, you know, where you pay monthly for access to books and audiobooks. And the audiobooks part of that could be, you know, the speaker solution is HomePod. And right now you cannot play audiobooks from iBooks on HomePod. Like, you can AirPlay it, but you can't even sync your progress, from what I understand. Like, it's per device, like, kind of really old fashioned compared to like what Amazon does, which is like sync your audiobook progress to an ebook, like with WhisperSync. Like, it's crazy what, you know, how good that is. You know, if they're serious about this service stuff, then like, that's the direction they need to tackle, I think.
Yeah, and Apple hired the old Audible, like, senior vice president to run iBooks, and they obviously came out with Apple Books in iOS 12. And I think if they want to do like audiobooks justice, they need some sort of subscription service, and then they need to break audiobooks into its dedicated app, because at the moment it's like buried inside the Apple Books experience on iOS. On the Mac, it's still in iTunes. It's just not in iBooks on the Mac.
Yeah.
And so not only is it hard to find, it's also just expensive. Like, a one-month subscription to Audible is cheaper than basically any book you can buy on the Apple Bookstore, any audiobook you can buy. Like,
yeah.
It's just, the economics just don't make sense, and they've just left it alone and ignored it. And kind of related to all that is that this week Apple actually released audiobook original content of sorts. So we've obviously been hearing all this stuff about Apple working on original content TV shows. They this week released 6 free audiobooks, no strings attached. You can just go and get them from the Apple Bookstore. They are original content in that they are new recordings, and they're recorded by celebrities like Karen Gillan and tight as Burgers, and there's even one recorded by like the Disney group for Winnie the Pooh. But the actual stories are public domain stories. So it's not new stories. It's like The Time Machine from H.G. Wells and Frankenstein and Pride and Prejudice. But I just thought it was cool that they hear some free stuff. And that kind of reinforces that maybe they are actually trying to do something more serious with audiobooks going forward. Because why else would they give away some free... Like, they're giving away this free stuff as like great first-time listens for you to then go and explore the audiobook section and raise awareness. And I think down the road, if they're going to be serious about it, they'll break it out into its own like audiobooks app. But for the time being, if you want to drive people to that section and like even make people aware that Apple sells audiobooks at all, how better than to release some free books?
Yeah, I was quick to go and like download these to make sure I get to take advantage of them, you know, if they ever went away for some reason. I'm a big fan of audiobooks. I will like aspirationally buy ebooks, and then sometimes I read them, sometimes I start and don't finish them. But an audiobook, if I will finish it even if I don't love it, because it's just like listening to a podcast for me. But if I love it, I'll listen to it like over and over and really enjoy it. So I grabbed these, and I just really hope that like this is a sign, you know, that they're going to invest more in the audiobook space as part of Apple Books rebranding. And I really want the Apple Watch to be able to not just like play audiobooks, but stream them. Because right now you can use Audible and you can send an audiobook to your Apple Watch for offline listening, but you've got to like go through the long sync process first, and it's not great. What I want is the cloud knows where you are, and you just stream it just like Apple Music, just like Apple Podcasts. Like, those work really well. I want that, but for Apple Books, Apple Audiobooks. Whether it's a purchase that you made or a subscription service that you subscribe to, I think that would be great. Not just for the Apple Watch. I mean, in theory, this would work on all of Apple's platforms, including HomePod and you know, maybe Echo. I don't know. But it was neat to see this. And I was also pleased by, like, readers' reaction to this story. It seemed to be pretty popular. Like, people were happy that Apple had released 6 free audiobooks read by celebrities. So, yay for
and I mean,
books and reading.
The audiobook section is so antiquated. Like, it was only, like, 2 years ago that they even added audiobooks to purchased in like the iTunes store. So if you bought a book and then you deleted it, an audiobook, it wasn't that too long ago where you just lost it forever,
right?
Like, because when they added all the you can download and find purchases over and over again for apps and music and stuff, that was like 2011 period, but it never applied to audiobooks until very, very recently. And the whole thing is just kind of ignored. Like, as much people complain that the iBooks was neglected, especially in the aftermath of the like the Amazon like competition trial,
right,
where it seemed like Apple kind of like distanced themselves from it as much as possible because they didn't want to get involved. And then obviously more recently, services are on the menu, so Apple Books is becoming more prominent again. But the audiobooks experience was even poorer. So they've got a long way to go, but hiring the Audible senior vice president to run the whole of Apple Books obviously puts audiobooks closer to someone caring about it.
95 Mac Happy Hour is sponsored by Ops Genie, now from Atlassian. Downtime is awful. You've lived through it, I've lived through it, and it's no fun. It doesn't matter if it's at home or at work or wherever you experience downtime. When a system you rely on goes down, it immediately throws a wrench in every part of your life. When it's worse is when you're the one responsible for fixing it, and you don't have a plan to manage your way through it. That's what Ops Genie is for. Ops Genie gives your team the power to respond quickly and efficiently to unplanned issues. Are any bad issues ever planned for? I think we all know how that goes. Ops Genie helps you notify the right people through a smart combination of scheduling and escalation paths that take into account things like time zones, vacations, and holidays. Obviously, you want the right person notified immediately, but if that person is not available, you want the next person notified without having to wait only to realize that the first call person isn't actually on call. This is where Ops Genie's smart magic comes into play. It knows because you've told it previously, back when times were calmer and you could think through it all. Ops Genie keeps track of all that for you, and when problems inevitably occur, Ops Genie is there to help. Also, now that Ops Genie is part of Atlassian, it opens to all kinds of integrations with things like Jira, Amazon CloudWatch, Datadog, New Relic, and more. That's what Atlassian is all about. They integrate well with their own solutions, but they also integrate with other popular solutions too. Check it out, opsgenie.com, to sign up for a free company account for up to 5 users. No credit card required, no time restrictions. This is a fully free account for you to actually use, not just try. That's opsgenie.com. Never miss a critical alert again with Ops Genie. Our thanks to Ops Genie by Atlassian for sponsoring the show. All right, Mayo, a couple more things for this week. I wrote a review today for something that was kind of unexpected, which is the Amazon Echo wall clock. And I think we mentioned when this thing like first got announced, it was probably like around September or so. They had this event where they had all the new Echo form factors and the microwave and the clock and some more stuff. And it just kind of like went away. Well, it was like Friday afternoon, and I saw, you know, tweets go by that the Echo wall clock is now available to purchase like for the first time. And I clicked it. It's only $29. So it's like it's in impulse purchase territory. And I'm very like, you know, Echo ecosystem curious. And so what's $30 to try it out? And it was promised to arrive by Tuesday. So I ordered 2 just in case it was a hot item that I really liked and I wanted to have, you know, like it went away or it got like just, you know, back ordered pretty quickly. So I ordered 2. Convinced a friend to buy one too that likes the Echo ecosystem, and so there's 3 Echo wall clocks sold. It arrived on Tuesday. I was excited to unbox it and set it up and put it on my wall, and today on Wednesday I got to write about it and review it. And what it is not an Echo, and it's kind of one of those things like where my first Apple TV, it was the second gen Apple TV, was like this, where I didn't know exactly what it was, but I liked the idea of it, and so I wanted to like buy and try it, and then, you know, it is what it is. And that's kind of what the Echo wall clock was for me. Like, I couldn't tell you when I bought it, like, what it could and couldn't do and, like, the ins and outs of it. And so it was kind of fun to have, like, a new toy to try out and see what
it could do. I'm going to guess that it tells you the time.
It is. It's an analog wall clock. It runs on 4 AA batteries. Comes with a drywall screw that you put in the wall, and then you hang it up. And it's neat. Like the setup process is you don't manually set the time like with a dial or with your hands or anything. You tell your Echo speaker, you say, "Alexa, set up my Echo wall clock." And if it's within, you know, 30 feet Bluetooth range, the Echo speaker that you spoke to finds it and it pairs with it. You've got to press the button for like 10 seconds and then like it pairs. And once it connects to the Echo speaker, the wall clock sets the time like automatically. And it's so neat to like watch the minute hand and the hour hand like go from, you know, like what, 12 o'clock to like the current time. And it's kind of like slow movement. It's like a race, but it's like once it gets to the right time, it just stops. It's like, oh, now it set itself. And it will also adjust for daylight savings time changes. So, like, if the hour changes for that reason and Amazon doesn't, like, mix it up, then your clock, even though it's an analog clock, like, by all appearances, it will adjust itself automatically, which is kind of neat.
Bluetooth,
indeed. Yeah, there's no, like, Wi-Fi built into the clock. There's no speaker or microphone on the clock. Like, it's just an analog-looking clock with Bluetooth that talks to the Echo speaker nearby. And then it has LEDs for each of the minute marks around the clock. And like one status light that barely is used for like pairing announcements or like error messages. But like the status light is almost not functional. It's not much there to it. The
lights that go around the outside.
Yeah, that's the thing that this thing's for. It's like if you use Echo speakers and you often set timers, this is like a display for those timers. And there are Echo speakers with screens, the Spot and the Show, and
It's kind of a little redundant if you've got one of those. Although those timers, like, I've not used the show because it's pricey and I don't want that thing. But the spot I do have. But even with that, the timer goes off screen after like 15 seconds. And then it goes to like different information cards. And so you don't have a constant like view of the timer, even though you have a screen on it. And with all Echo speakers, you can ask Alexa for an update on your whatever timer and it'll tell you. And you get the alert whenever it's done. So it's like, it doesn't really add much to it, except it's a wall clock. So I've never, like on my own, had a wall clock before. Because just the idea of like setting the time manually and like having something that's not connected in my life like doesn't make any sense for me. But this is connected, even though it's like an analog wall clock, you know, by all appearances. But the thing that you do is you say, Alexa, set a timer for 5 minutes, and then the minute marks from 12 through 1 light up, and that's your 5 minute timer. And as each minute passes, you lose, you know, one of the LEDs goes off, and then you've got 4 minutes left, 3 minutes left.
So it's like a progress bar.
Exactly. And then in the last 60 seconds of the timer, all of the LEDs light up around the dial, all 60 minutes, and it counts down, you know, from backwards. And then when the timer goes off, the Echo speaker alarms you, you know, tells you, and then the LEDs in the clock like light up. And in my review, I've got I didn't do a video, but I recorded video and then made that into a GIF or like various GIFs, and so you can see like each of these animations playing out. And because Echo supports multiple timers, you know, long before HomePod got there, you can do a 5 minute timer, and then you can add a 15 minute timer, for example. And then the number 3 will have like one light by it, as the number 5, like 12 through 1, have, you know, all of those lit up. So there's a way. Yeah, there's a way that it can communicate multiple timers. And I've done like 3 or 4 at the same time. I'm not sure what the limit is, but you can support like lots of those. I guess if you went over an hour, it would be a little tricky. And there's nothing like alarm connected to it. Like you can't like have it be an alarm clock in any way. Like it's just a wall clock for the current time. And a way to display like timer progress from an Echo speaker. It's kind of neat. Like for me, it's $30. Like if it was like $100, no way, I wouldn't recommend it. But for like $30, if you need a wall clock already, and you're in the Echo ecosystem, this is a neat thing to have. And the second one that I bought, I'm gonna give to my mother-in-law as like a Christmas present because she's requested an Echo Dot third gen for Christmas that she's receiving, and I'm just gonna like throw this in with that. I think it'll be a neat thing like, for the kitchen. So, you know, it's
a funny mix of like very, very basic technology.
Yeah.
Cause it's not like an LCD screen, obviously it's just fixed LEDs that light up, but you know, my stance on smart clocks, I've been pushing this train for a while.
You have.
This actually just popped in my mind as you're talking. Probably when I was in like 2005, I was like 10 years old. And I went to this entrepreneur camp thing for like a day. And it was like, you come up with, you do these little activities. And the end was like a fake pitch of like a product.
Yeah.
And I pitched a smart wall clock that would show like your emails and your phone calls and stuff. So I'm getting vindicated. They shot it down at the time. We didn't win. But decades later, I'm getting vindicated. The wall clocks, the alarm clocks like the Echo Spot, they're coming back into fashion.
They are. Now with the Echo Wall Clock, you would probably think that it should include Alexa like built into it. But I think that then it would need to be like wall powered and not like battery powered. And so all of a sudden it's like a different thing. And it's kind of closer to like what an Echo Spot is. And then it's not $30, it's like, you know, $100. So I'm kind of happy with like the balance of like how basic it is plus what it can do. It's kind of neat in that regard. Only other like limit in practice that I found is that you know,
there's no second hand.
Well, there's that. If you have another Echo nearby, like if it catches the timer request, like it's only one clock paired with one Echo. So like you've got to be careful with that. Otherwise, you don't get the benefit. I mean, your timer is going to go off either way. You just wouldn't have it added to the clock. So there can be downsides to having too many Alexa targets in different places. So
that is a bit of an annoyance.
Yeah.
Because especially if you're like putting this in a big kitchen, it's not unreasonable to have like an Echo in the kitchen and then an Echo in the hallway, like a dot in the hallway, and then one of them accidentally listens instead. Like that may be something they can sort out maybe, because they could like relay the time, because you're not sending like loads of complex data. It's just the percentage of the timer remaining, essentially. So they could probably relay that. Amazon could, like, relay that through and send it over and, like, coordinate it better in the future.
Yeah. Because, what I would expect is, like, no matter what Echo picks it up, like, it shows up on the clock. If you only have one clock. If you have multiple clocks, then I guess it's confusing. But, it isn't like the clock dings or anything. There's no, like, ticking sounds or alarm sounds or any of that. It's all from the Echoes that go off. So that's one thing. The other thing is, like you said, I called it in the review, there's no second hand, which is, like, not hard to do on a battery-powered clock, like, even with these features. So that kind of bothers me is, like, yeah, they kind of make up for it with the countdown LED for the last 60 seconds of a timer. But just in general, like, I like a second hand of, like, you know, where are we within the minute? I have the seconds turned on my iMac. It's like in the clock in the corner of the screen, because it's like something comforting to me about, like, where are we within the minute right now that I like. And
my secondary school had radio control clocks, which use, like, the atomic clock to stay in time. So, because obviously for a big school, you don't want to be constantly getting the clocks down to readjust the times. Yeah. And they definitely had second hands, and they were definitely battery powered. So it's not like, you know, this isn't a feat of technology. It's just like a cool little thing that Amazon's doing. I do think it's a bit kind of, by calling it, putting Echo in its name so prominently, it kind of sets you up to think it's like a proper Echo when it's not. It's like an Echo accessory more than anything else.
It's kind of like the Echo look, how the Echo look is not an Echo speaker, like, at all.
Mm-hmm.
And it does not, it has Alexa, I guess, but it's like the main thing it does is, like, interact with the app on the iPhone or Android, I guess.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's a weird one, and, like, it probably needs to go away. But, like, where Echo look is, like, I think stupid. I think Echo wall clock is, like, an accessory that it is fun, and it's kind of, like, there's something about it that I wrote in the review that's, like, just delightful about it, because, like, it doesn't overpromise anything. If anything, like, it almost makes no promises. and it's, like, it's almost just a wall clock, and then it has some neat things that it can do, like automatically set the time, adjust the time for changes in DST, and then the timer stuff, and that's it. Like, nothing more to it. The other complaint about it is, like, the build quality. Even for a $29, you know, clock, it could be a little bit nicer. The biggest thing for me is the plastic over the face of the clock. It picks up fingerprints like crazy, so you got to be careful when you're setting it up to not cover it with fingerprints. And it picks up glare like crazy, which in a kitchen environment, like, in every home I've lived in, like, kitchens have, like, these big long tube lights that are really hard to make work with HomeKit, and I just give up on them. But they're, like, big light sources. And so on the Echo clock, like, it's got a black background, and then the plastic picks up that glare, like, pretty badly. So it's, like, worse in photos, but even in practice, like, it's kind of noticeable at certain angles. And then I've only opened mine. I've not seen the other two that I know that were ordered, but mine came pre-scuffed. Like, the plastic, it's, like, almost like there's something I should peel off of it that would make it new, but it came, like, pre-scuffed, where, like, there's, like marks on it, and you don't see them at, like, a distance when it's hanging on the wall. But I could easily take a close-up picture and, like, show someone these are the scuffs on it, you know? And I think it's just because, like, it was a day one purchase of, like, a hobby product, you know? But even for $30, like, they could have a little bit more quality control, I think, over the materials. But as a concept, it's neat. And if you are in the Echo ecosystem and you do things like set timers for cooking, it's kind of a neat thing to have. Like, I do not recommend it if you're, you know, fit that bill there. So it's neat. I like it. Echo wall clock. Who knew? Kind of a surprise thing too. And the other thing I wanted to do this week is a little catch up on the iPad Pro experience, since the new iPad Pro came out. I've been using it a lot, and, you know, eventually went from the base 11-inch model to the 12.9-inch model with LTE and then 256 gigabytes of storage. I mentioned before that I was using the app Prompt Smart to take the scripts for 9to5 Mac Daily that I'll write or add scripts and have them in teleprompter form, and the app will, as you speak, it'll recognize what you're saying and move the prompter
Follow along.
Yeah, for you, right? And it's super natural, and I really recommend it. And I decided to buy the pro version just to support the app because it's that good. And there's some things that I've done with that, like just in testing. I've not like released things using this method, but you can record audio in the PromptSmart app on the iPad. And so just for like to see if it was possible, I connected my Rode Podcaster mic over USB-B to USB-C directly into the iPad and read the script, followed the prompt, and it recorded it in PromptSmart. Which so then I had like podcast quality audio in the app on the iPad, which is really neat. And optionally, you can record video using one of the cameras. And so, you know, the easiest thing to do, like in the test, was to record from the front-facing camera, so that's 720p. If you use the rear camera and maybe like a mirror system, you could have the teleprompter and a mirror, and then use the back camera to record 4K video from the iPad. So you'd be recording high quality audio, 4K video, and then using the iPad as a teleprompter at the same time in like one app. And that was pretty impressive. And I tried
like that patches over a problem if you're trying to just use the iPad on its own. Yep. In multitasking with like a camera app is difficult on iOS
very
today,
so,
because stuff takes steals focus and it disables itself. So by having it all in the same app, they obviously answer a big use case of, you know, I actually want to record this at the same time.
Yeah. So that was just like neat to see that be done from an iPad. And I was just doing this like out of like hobby kind of fun to see if it's possible. And it was really easy to do. I'm not going to like turn 9to5 Mac Daily into like a video thing yet, you know, anytime soon or anything, but just to see like, could that be done? It was fun to try out. And then I took the video and I put it in Luma Fusion, the video editing app on the iPad. And it was like, I find that apps that have a learning curve, I shy away from. Like if I need to invest time in like learning them, then I probably won't for a while. But with Luma Fusion, I was like poking around and I was able to bring in the video that PromptSmart Pro recorded and the audio, and then like from files, like drag in artwork for 9to5 Mac Daily, and then in the intro music, and I could just like layer it all and make like a little like sample clip of like the ding for the podcast music with the artwork first, and then like once it transitions to me, like go to the video. And I'm not a video editor, but like it was just possible and it was like easy to do. And so I was really impressed by that. So I think there's something to that. I might eventually make this like part of something I do, but just I've never tried all this on the Mac before in like a way that I would be curious about. And then on the iPad, it just felt like really approachable using just those two apps. So that was really neat. And the other thing is last week's 9to5 Mac Happy Hour podcast, I edited in Ferrite for the first time. And I think I mentioned last week that like I had a moment of weakness where I was like, maybe I should have a MacBook Air instead of like the iPad Pro for like mobile work. And I thought to myself, like, no, I've spent like MacBook Air price money. I know the iPad's got like the power behind it. I think if I learn to use some apps that I'm not comfortable with, then I can get more use out of it. And it was the same way with the Mac. Like, you've got to learn the apps before you can get the use out of the power. So I kind of forced myself to use Ferrite to edit a podcast. And what I found is that it does some things much better and more efficiently than like using GarageBand or Logic on the Mac does. And I think that the episode that came out sounded better than it
was. Yeah, I think it sounded better as well. And we received no complaints about audio quality or editing quality or anything like that.
The only mistake that I made was we had one segment where I had set an alarm to notify both of us that it was the end of like my recording window and I had to go pick up my kid from daycare. But one of my Echoes is set to Eastern time and I'm in Central time. And this is a mistake of like how Echoes come pre-configured if you order from Amazon. And I need to change my default like address or something in Amazon because I keep getting them sent in Eastern time configuration. And so my 5:30 timer went off, or alarm went off at like 4:30 and it interrupted our show. And then I forgot to edit that part out initially, and at least one person caught it. I'm sure a lot of people caught it, but like I was embarrassed by it because, you know, it caught me off guard as I was listening back to it. And so quickly on the iPad, I then needed to learn how to use Ferrite to select like a group of audio blocks from this point on. And so like, I had to like look into it. Like how do I do this quickly? Cause I'm kind of under pressure here. And I was able to figure it out and use the Apple Pencil double tap gesture as like a way to do that. It was neat. it was like from that mistake and that pressure, you know, kind of forced myself to learn. And since then, like every episode of 9to5 Mac Daily that I've released, Electric's podcast with Seth and Fred about electric energy and Tesla, I'm doing totally on the iPad now. Like, and this episode will be iPad. Like, I'm just, it's now easier for me to edit the podcast on the iPad. Whereas before, like, I thought it would be inferior in every way and like kind of a gimmick. Like, now I'm a big fan. Like, and I think if the same software ran on the Mac, like, I would just, maybe I'd use the Mac if I was working on the Mac, or I would use the iPad if I was mobile. But right now, like, I'm happy enough with the software on the iPad that, like, I'll turn to the iPad to do that work, you know, for editing the podcast. And I think the end result's better.
Yeah, you are definitely further along, like, the iPad gravy train than I expected you to be when you bought it.
Me too. Me too.
You use it for, like, you've written multiple stories on it now for 9to5 Mac, like, online. You do podcast editing. During the day, you always send me screenshots from the iPad, not from a Mac anymore. So I'm like, wow, you're into it properly.
Yeah, it's funny because like I've never gone without an iPad, but it's just like going from the 9.7 inch base model iPad Pro from a few years ago to like, you know, to a newer version with different features. It can change how you can use it, and I'm optimistic that like future software will make it even better. But I'm not, you know, I'm never planning on features that aren't there yet. And so from what's there today, I'm really happy with what I'm able to do. And even like, you know, I don't know if you can tell, this week I've got a cold, a sinus infection. And so like yesterday, I went to the doctor during work hours because I knew that work was going to be way worse if I didn't go to the doctor first and like get a shot. And I've tried to like do scenarios like that where I try to not miss like what's going on with work and also like make an appointment, like a doctor's appointment for family or myself. And I've in the past, I've taken an iPad and a MacBook. And the idea is like the iPad is great for like monitoring the situation and like tablet mode, like flat, no keyboard dangling off or anything like that. You know, keyboard folded back's fine. And then like the laptop is like great for like when you're wanting to produce something, you know, really, really quickly. And I find that, you know, the 12-inch MacBook was really portable because it was small and it ran Mac OS. But if you can learn how to use the iPad and iOS apps as efficiently, then the portability of like an iPad being just a screen and the smart keyboard folio being like a cover that folds back or can be a keyboard, like it really works for me. And so, and LTE, you know, obviously is helpful. So I took the iPad to the doctor's appointment and I never felt like I was offline or like disconnected. I wasn't writing from the appointment because I was like obviously engaged with seeing the doctor. But I saw Slack, I saw TweetDeck, Twitter timeline, and I like worked on my inbox, you know, my yeah. email inbox. And it was like, I felt productive for that like 2 hour period.
And you know, you wouldn't take your laptop to that place and have it out.
Or there's no way.
You'd bring it in your bag and then you'd literally never open it.
Yeah. Cause it's just the ergonomics of like an open clamshell, you know, thing is like, it's in the way. Even if it's like opened as wide as possible, it's like in the way. So I'm really happy with how this is going. The other thing is I've ordered, okay, well I'll back up a little bit. So I've found that like using some software on the iPad, I really like, and even with the bigger screen, it's nice, but I want it to be like bigger than it already is. So my workaround has been connecting an app like Prompt Smart Pro to my, like have it display on my Mac display by using USB-C, I guess to USB-C in this case with the iMac, and then opening QuickTime and then creating a new movie recording without hitting record and then having the video source be the iPad Pro. Like it's quite a workaround, but once you get it down, you can do it pretty quickly. And then that displays the iPad screen on your iMac. So all of a sudden, the 12.9-inch display is like up to 27 inches. It's really neat. And so I'll have my podcast microphone in front of me and my script for 9to5 Mac Daily in front of me as teleprompter form, you know, with the iPad over here on the side, but it's big and like ergonomically where I want it to be. And I'll record the audio to the Mac, but like it's from, you know, viewing iPad software on the Mac. It's kind of neat. It's like, you know, it gets into Marzipan territory of like, if only this app could run on the Mac just as well, like that'd be really cool. But I'm literally running like the iPad software displayed on the Mac display. And so I did that enough that that was a nest. Like I felt like that was a part of my workflow that I liked enough that like I didn't want to give it up. So I started looking at displays for the iPad because what I want is this iPad experience, but just on a bigger screen at my desk, like in a fixed place. And this, you know, because the mic's in its place and my chair is where it is. And it's just like, it's, you know, works out for me. Mm-hmm. And so I was looking at like, what would a USB-C 4K display cost? And, you know, I kind of asked you like, what do you think? And you said around $300. So I looked at the market and it's like, well, you can get like a 4K HDMI display for around that price. But if you want,
yeah, USB-C... I was actually surprised that the USB-C displays are still quite pricey.
Yeah. They're quite pricey. And you're looking at 4K with like larger than what you'd want screen sizes for Retina. And you're looking, you know, maybe double that price. So I was thinking, no, I just won't bother with this. But I found a deal of a refurbished LG 4K ultrafine display on eBay for like between $300 and $400. And I ordered that. It arrives on Friday. And it's gonna kind of double as like it can extend my iMac and also be a Retina display on the side, like a smaller iMac on the side, which can be useful. Or it can be the iPad display when I want to make what's on the iPad much larger. And in those modes where like the iPad is just a display, like it's processing what I'm saying and that kind of thing, but I don't need to like interact with it, I think that'll be pretty ideal. If I'm ever like needing to touch the iPad screen a lot, I don't think I'll use a display for it. And I really hope that like a future version of iOS takes more advantage of external displays like this, especially with USB-C. But, you know, not hold my breath there.
Yeah.
Yeah. But for now, like, for what I was doing, you know, with QuickTime was like a hack. and the fact that the display can also extend my iMac, that'll be useful. I've kind of like gone on this, you know, I'm in no way saying like I'm switching to iPad. I couldn't do that.
But yeah, you're nowhere close to iPad only.
No way at all. No way. But I'm definitely getting efficient with it and in ways that complement what I do on the Mac. And I'll also say like, once you can learn to work, if you can learn to do things on iPad that you did on Mac before, you can often filter some of that back down to the iPhone too. Like I wrote a post about a Things app update last week entirely from my iPhone using tricks I learned to use on the iPad because it's still iOS, it's just smaller. And like the screen, you know, size constraint was like way worse, but I was in a situation where I had a deadline and I wanted to be way ahead of the deadline and not like last minute. And I was, my son was asleep on me and I was like laying in bed and I was like, you know, I could probably do most of this from the iPhone right now and like finish on the Mac. And it turns out I was able to like put together custom images and do all the same things I do on the Mac with the story, but from the iPhone using tricks I learned to do on the iPad. So it was really, really neat to do that. Like then, and you look at the story, you can't tell a difference. Like there's no difference in it. The difference, I guess, is like speed. Like, if I'm on work hours, then I'm on the Mac because I need to be as fast as possible. But if it's after hours and it's just like...
More chilled, yeah.
Yeah, more chilled. Then iOS is like kind of awesome for that.
Yeah, so. Let me ask you like an A or B, right? So you're editing a podcast. Okay, you're doing this podcast. Mm-hmm. Is it more enjoyable? Do you like it more, regardless of output quality and rendering speed? Just do you like it more editing the podcast on the Mac with a mouse and keyboard or on the iPad with keyboard and touch and pencil? Like, which would you pick?
Huh. Like, so if I had like Farah on the Mac, right now I would probably like just out of habit go back like use the Mac. And I think it's the mouse input that gets me. And if like some form of that came to the iPad, I would probably pick iPad. But it's something like selecting blocks of audio is a little tricky, like multiple selections and stuff. Like, there's still some limiting factors there that could be addressed in iOS, or, and the pencil can help out with, but it's still like, I'm still kind of learning that, like, how this all works. Probably the Mac right now, just because of like the ability to take a cursor and like click and hold and drag and make a big web, you know, like a big selection. Unfair, what I found is that there's probably another way to do it, like through the UI, but I found a quick option for double tap on the pencil, the new gesture, and that selects everything after a certain audio point. So other than that, like I think the solution is tap and hold and then tap another object and tap another object, and it's like a lot of tapping involved, and I haven't quite learned how to like make a big selection of just like chunks of audio yet. If I got that down, which maybe is an obvious thing there that I've not picked up on yet, then maybe the iPad, just because like there's something like this is part of it too, is I liked the 12-inch MacBook because there's no fan and it feels like it's instant and alive as like iOS does, where it's just like it is what it is and there's no like fan blowing in the background. The MacBook Air is a fan. Like I don't want that anymore. Like once you use a 12-inch MacBook, I think it's really nice. The iPad is like, faster, it's powerful. There's no fan involved though. And it's just like, it feels very responsive and like very modern. And, having a smart keyboard folio makes it more like a laptop and keyboard input. So in that regard, like I'm definitely moving closer to like liking the iPad in that scenario where, it's just a few more things that I can do in the Mac that I'd want to pick up on the iPad. And then
because the reason I asked you the question is when I'm using my iPad to do stuff, when I'm in the realm of the stuff that the iPad can actually do, like, I way prefer using touch and doing it like that way. It just feels so much more enjoyable. It's where I'd opt to go to if I could. And stuff just holds it back. And I think the amount of progress that you can make in a relatively short time, right, in actually doing actual stuff at a reasonable speed, not really impaired by much, it just shows that this is the future. Like, the tablet touchscreen stuff is the direction, whether that's the mobile tablet or something bigger like Surface Studio, like Easily desk stuff. Like, that has to be the direction of where everything is going. It's just getting there is you got to get over the humps to the point where you could actually not have your Mac on the same desk as the iPad. Like, that's where we're hoping iOS 13, 14, 15 is taking us, like, so to the point where you can feel confident enough that you can actually do everything on the iPad and everything will be way more fun than it is on the Mac today. And just that's where you'd want to go, in the same way that it's like, people often can be sitting in front of their laptop and they still text on their phone because it's just way more natural to do like chat on your phone.
It's that
but applied to like productivity and enjoyment and like and media. Like people always think I'm like super negative on like the iPad stuff and it's like, oh, I'm a big Mac fanboy. It's like, no, I way prefer the iPad, like for the functionality that it can do, and I'm just waiting for that to be, uniform across everything that we need computers to do for us.
Yeah. So I'll end on this. There's a story we published last night that was I wrote that was 2018 iPad Pros are portable enough for split keyboards and floating iPhone keyboards. So the idea there is that on iPad Pros. On iPad Mini, iPad, and iPad Pro 10.5 inch, you can have a split keyboard where you the keyboard pulls up and splits in half, and you can type with your thumbs and hold the iPad from the back. And on 11 inch iPad and all 12.9 inch iPads, unless you use Display Zoom, you can't do that, and it's quite annoying because it's more ideal on a bigger screen than a smaller screen, because on a smaller screen you can probably thumb type with a regular keyboard anyway. And Gruber wrote a thing on Daring Fireball about it, and I took it and built on top of that with his was like a quick text thing. I wanted to use some images to kind of build my case on that too, and throw in the mix of, we saw in code years ago, this like floating iPhone keyboard on iPad that never got released. But the reason I mentioned all this is that is a story that I wrote from the iPad top to bottom, including all the images that are in there, like the screenshots with the device frames and background gradient and like inline text, quotes, video, timestamp video, by the way, and like, all these different things. It's like, I don't know if I would have guessed that I could have done that from the iPad before, but like, it's just like an exercise. Like, once you practice, you get better at it and better at it.
And you're publishing from the WordPress online CMS, right, in Safari?
Yeah, I'm not touching the app because we have so much stuff with 9to5 Mac and the CMS that I don't think the app would be good for, like, have access to, check this box, put text here, make this customization.
Yeah.
I don't think the app would be a viable option.
The same way, the app isn't good enough. But like for me, the point is, you're actually getting this done in a web app that is not like, I mean, this iPad experience that is tuned for this. Like you're doing it in a website to relatively close to the same as you would do on a Mac. Like imagine if they actually had a proper, you know, WordPress app experience, which could include all the plugins and everything like that. Then it would be, you know, 10 times better than that even, because it'd actually be touch optimized and everything else.
Yeah, the only thing that gets me with WordPress, and I think I mentioned this a few weeks ago too, is that if you're in the kind of like visual, what you see is what you get sort of editor, the cursor, like where you can tap a word and put the cursor there, but if you double tap and you want to like drag to select the text or like multiple text, all of a sudden you break the paradigm of like where your finger is where the cursor is and like wants to go. And it's not mapped the same way. Like the UI around the text box is mapped to touch, but the text box is like off for some reason. And so it gets out of hand like fast. And you can switch to the like HTML view, and then all of a sudden I think it works out better that way. But if you're in like the visual editor, you can kind of figure it out. But like your finger might be a few inches from where the cursor actually is moving.
And, yeah, it's like offset.
Yeah, and it's like that's a hack to even like work around that. Or on the Mac, like there's not a problem. But it's just like how it's working on the web with touch, and it's not meant to be that way, I guess. But if it wasn't for that problem, I think I would be like even further ahead than I've already become so far. But I mean, you know, the work hours totally on the Mac like all day long, and the Mac is like there's always the fallback of like I can use screens to like access the Mac to, you know, grab files or, you know, check something, and there's all kind of things that I use that I wouldn't even be able to do well on a laptop anymore, you know, having different services like alert me that are always running and actively checking for updates in the background. And I don't worry about that on a Mac, but on a desktop, but on a laptop, I don't worry about battery life. You know, like that stuff would need like a server behind it instead of my desktop behind it. But it's impressive stuff. And it surprised me. Like I bought this iPad because it looks pretty, you know what I mean? Like that was the big selling point for me, is that it's a new design. It's the iPhone 10.
You came in with a definitely media consumption experience coming in.
Totally, yep. And I definitely feel like I've advanced from there. So yay, the new iPad Pros. So, and you are sitting this one out still.
Yeah, I'm. For now, I know. Like, I'm not going to use mine more than what I use my current one until software changes. When software changes, I'll get a new one for sure. Like, the problem for me is, as well as like work hours for me, is not just, oh, I'm doing blogging stuff, which I could do on the iPad, but it'd be slower. It's also doing app development stuff, which I just can't do on the iPad, full stop. So it kind of just shuts the door on it. Like,
it's not like
putting up with inconvenience. It's just I can't do it. So I'm waiting. Like, and I'll probably get a new iPad before the development stuff is fledged out. But if they had like a proper, fully fledged like writing, integrated multitasking stuff, then that'd be enough for me to get it. But at the moment, it's like, the writing's, you know, average, and my other half of my work, I just can't do at all. So when it gets closer along that line, then I'm coming back. I love the iPad. I just, software, come on.
Yeah, I mean, you're still a 2015 12.9
OG, rocking the original. Oh, and yeah, I was complaining about the split keyboard from day one, 3 years ago.
Yep. So the thing is, like whether it's iPad or MacBook or iMac or any other desktop, you know, Mac, whatever it is, like there's different benefits and trade-offs that you have. And I'm really comfortable with iPad plus iMac. But if I hadn't sold my MacBook, or like I had a MacBook Pro, like once there's like too much overlap, then it's really confusing, and I'm not going to like invest time in learning, you know, to use software on iOS that I am now. But by having the constraint of my iMac is not portable at all, like that makes me want to learn the iPad more as a portable solution. And for work, there's rarely a time where I don't need to be like in my home office. And it's like maybe 5 days out of the year that I need to like travel and be somewhere else. But I'm not when I'm traveling, I'm not doing the same thing I'm doing at home. So like the iPad will be fine for that. So I'm happy with the new setup, and I think it'll stick for a while too. Mainly because, you know, the iMac Pro, even refurbished, was a big investment.
Yeah.
This iPad ended up not being as cheap as I wanted it to be, and then I upgraded. So, you know, it's gonna stick this time. It has to. It's expensive. So, all right, that's the Happy Hour podcast this week. Thanks for listening. If you have any feedback, you can email us at happyhour@95mac.com. You can also follow us on Twitter. I'm at Apollo Zach. Benjamin, you are?
BZA Maya.
All right, and we'll be back next week. Bye, everybody.